Are you looking for Christmas cards that combine beautiful art with a clear Christian confession? Emmanuel Press offers Christ-centered, affordable cards in a variety of designs. You'll find cards with stained glass, illumination, German frescoes, and other unique artwork found only at Emmanuel Press. Visit their website, emmanuelpress.us, E-M-M-A-N-U-E-L, press.us.
You know, it is, it's just awfully good that someone with the temperament of Donald Trump is not in charge of the law in our country.
Yeah, because you'd be in jail.
Secretary Clinton.
That's Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton speaking Sunday night at the second presidential debate held here in St. Louis. A few of the fireworks there, some of it was more mundane, perhaps even boring. The expectations were, well, either high or low, depending on how you look at it. We're going to talk about that debate on Sunday night and our regular weekly update on the November elections with Mark and Molly Hemingway. We're going to discuss some of the things that happened at the debate, but also talk about why, even after some have said that Donald Trump soundly won that debate Sunday night, he is, I think at last count, 11 or 13 points behind Hillary Clinton. Joining us for our weekly update on the November elections and some armchair quarterbacking on the debate, Mark Hemingway, senior writer for the Weekly Standard. Mark, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Glad to be here.
And Molly Hemingway, senior editor for The Federalist. Molly, welcome to you.
Great to be here with you.
Molly, let's talk a little bit about how one summarizes what happened Sunday night. If you're at the water cooler with a coworker who didn't have an opportunity to watch the debate, the second presidential debate, but was generally up on the facts, how would you summarize it for them?
Yeah, I was myself a little nervous about the debate going into it, and it turned out to be a very substantive, contentious, clarifying debate that was also very entertaining. I actually enjoyed it a great deal. It did have high viewership. I think it was in the 60 millions, which was still much less than the first debate, which was in the 80 millions. But it was just a terrifically entertaining debate where both candidates were able to talk about what they wanted the election to be about, and they both were a little bit more honest about their differences. So it was just a good show all around.
Don't get me wrong. I agree with everything Molly said, but I mean, again, it was also sort of a depressing exercise in civics as well. If there was a time when, like, maybe you would have sat, you know, one of your children in front of the television to have them watch a presidential debate, you know, as some sort of a lesson about the country. I mean, we spent so much time in this debate talking about, you know, which candidate was more enabling of sexual assault, that it was thoroughly depressing in other ways. It was substantive on the issues around the margins. Trump was surprisingly substantive. Granted, we're grading on a big curve for him because he's not a guy that really deals in policy specifics, but he did seem to come through in that way a lot more than he did in the previous debate, and frankly, he has a lot more throughout most of the campaign. Trump held his own and had turned into a pretty good performance. I think most people agree that he won insofar as one wins by point scoring. But, who knows how it's necessarily going to play with the broader American audience at this point in time.
What was the shining moment and what was the dark moment for both these candidates, Molly, in your opinion, beginning with Secretary Clinton?
You know, they always say about the debates that they are about moments instead of overarching messages or whatnot. You think back to previous debates and you remember Ronald Reagan saying, "There he goes again," or "There you go again." And Hillary Clinton didn't really have any moments like that. She gave a very good debate performance. She was in control. She was calm. But she was on the defensive. So I actually don't remember much of for a high point, except when she spoke about Donald Trump's temperament, and she had a really good way of talking about how he lacks the temperament to be president. And I was very struck by it. The only problem being that Donald Trump immediately took that thunder away when he quipped that she said he shouldn't be in power because of his temperament, and he quipped something about how she says that because she would be in jail if I were in power. And this was his best moment. I mean, it was just an unbelievable taking advantage of an opportunity that she gave him to remind people of the problem with Hillary Clinton's candidacy, being that she has broken the law and gotten away with it due to a corrupt legal system that was designed to exonerate her instead of hold her accountable. He'd earlier said that he would appoint a special independent prosecutor to investigate her lawbreaking, since the, you know, what we're learning about the Department of Justice and how much collusion there was between the White House and the different agencies to protect Hillary Clinton. And I think that was definitely a high mark for him. It was also the low mark if you listen to what most people in the media say. They thought that his claim that she should be held accountable for her mishandling of classified information meant that he wanted to punish her merely for being a Democrat or being a political enemy. But he, in general, kept it together. His first debate performance was really bad because he was on defense and he was talking about himself. In this case, Hillary Clinton was mostly on defense, talking about herself. He, at one point, I think the worst or silliest part for him was when he started voluntarily talking about his taxes when nobody actually asked him about it. So I think that was his big debate flub, but he generally took advantage of the opportunities presented him.
Mark, from your seat on the couch, a shining or darkest moment for you to the candidates?
Yeah, well, actually, I thought that there were a few moments where Hillary Clinton did well because it was a town hall debate. There were a precious few moments where she was addressing someone in the audience, and I thought she generally came off well for Hillary Clinton, who's not the best retail politician. She did a very good job, I think, of explaining Obamacare, for instance, and how she was going to handle that issue to a member in the crowd. She did that well as a politician. I mean, I still think she's dead wrong in the substance of Obamacare, and certainly the law is already falling apart of its own accord. But she came across as very sort of, you know, human and, you know, speaking frankly to the members of the audience. So that was sort of a high point for her. You know, the low point for her was that Donald Trump took the fight to her on his so-called locker room comments, you know, and dredged up all her husband's past behavior and the fact that she was complicit in enabling her husband's behavior and even targeting the women that were accusing him of assaulting them sexually and all kinds of, you know, inappropriate behavior. And she just sat there kind of smiling and had, like, no response whatsoever to it. I think the, you know, but Hillary, you know, argument in response to the concern of Trump's comments is more effective than people realize. Having said that, I think that both of them are, you know, should be disqualified from a higher office based on their behavior toward women. As for Trump, I agree with Molly that there's been a lot of, you know, people in the media on fainting couches over his, she'd be in jail comment. I agree that the rhetoric of putting your opponent in jail is somewhat discomforting, especially since Trump has an authoritarian streak otherwise. But if you heard the remarks in context, and it sounded to me more like he was saying that she would be in jail because if this had happened on his watch, because he's a guy that believes in enforcing the law as opposed to the Obama administration, which I don't think anybody can really defend their conduct of this, considering that Obama endorsed Hillary Clinton while the FBI investigation was still going on and refused to appoint a special prosecutor, which is what he really should have done. And further, you know, the flip side of that is that Clinton and Obama's behavior in this regard has been terrible. You know, Hillary Clinton and Obama basically had the maker of a YouTube video arrested to, you know, cover up the fact they made a big foreign policy mistake in Libya, and, you know, and they didn't want to admit that the terror attack that occurred on September 11th, 2012 was a terror attack rather than something that was motivated by some, you know, extraneous, blasphemous YouTube video. And then, you know, Obama in particular joked about having the IRS go after his enemies, and then they did. And there's been precious little media outrage about these kinds of things. So the idea that people are all of a sudden, you know, saying, oh, my stars and garters, about Trump saying he would enforce the law, and I think we all know Hillary Clinton is guilty of violating it, you know, really is something that I just don't understand. But, you know, if it feeds into Trump's general authoritarian impulses, I mean, I guess I kind of get it, but I think they're making too much of it, and I think it's actually going to play well.
If I can make a point there, too, Hillary Clinton, during that same debate, said that she wanted to overturn, you know, have a justice appointed to the Supreme Court who could overturn Citizens United. You want an authoritarian streak, going after people who publish things that are critical of Hillary Clinton. I don't know if people remember that Citizens United dealt with a group of citizens who had published a movie or had made a movie that was critical of Hillary Clinton. And the decision protects the right of filmmakers and authors and journalists to be critical of candidates prior to their election. This is a hugely important First Amendment issue. And the idea that we can only see the authoritarianism of Donald Trump and not the very scary authoritarianism of Hillary Clinton is discomforting.
Molly Hemingway is senior editor for The Federalist and Mark Hemingway, senior writer for The Weekly Standard. So, if Donald Trump, either by general impression or points, scored one Sunday's debate, why is he double digits behind his opponent? We'll talk about that after this.
There are nearly 20 million college students in the United States. 40% will stop going to church during college. 50% will never return. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is seeking to meet this challenge through LCMSU. Why? Because 100% of college students matter to God and to His church. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help. LCMSU. Check us out at lcms.org/lcmsu.
Join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club in October, and we'll send you a limited edition Here I Stand t-shirt. Find out more about our monthly or annual giving program at issuesetc.org. Just click the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses, or call Craig 618-223-8385. Join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club by Reformation Day, and we'll send you a limited edition long sleeve shirt along with your other membership benefits. The Issues Etc. Reformation Club.
This is Pastor Philip Hauser with Lamb of God Lutheran Church in Papillion, Nebraska. We're faithful to the Lutheran confessions as recorded in the Book of Concord, and our services are traditional Eucharistic liturgies in accordance with the ancient texts Saturday evening and Sunday morning. If you're ever in Omaha, come visit us. We're on Lincoln Street between 84th and 96th in Papillion. Our website is lambofgodlcms.org.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
When a Christian woman is critical of her own flesh, she holds her Creator in contempt.
Rose Adel from her new book, Ladylike, Living Biblically.
Our Heavenly Father knit us together in the womb. He did not do a bad job. We are fearfully and wonderfully made. Psalm 139:14. That goes for everyone, including the one who thinks she's the ugliest of them all.
You can purchase and download Concordia Publishing House's new audiobook, Ladylike, Living Biblically, at Amazon, Audible, and iTunes.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're getting both a little armchair quarterback on the Sunday night debate between the two presidential hopefuls here in St. Louis, and an update on the November elections with Mark Hemingway of the Weekly Standard and Molly Hemingway of the Federalist. Mark, if Donald Trump, by either general impression or by somehow points scored, if he won Sunday's debate, why is he double digits behind his opponent?
Well, that's kind of a complex factor at this point in time. I mean, I think obviously for whatever reason, something about that video just really sent people over the edge. And it's really bizarre because you know, it's not anything we didn't already know about Trump. He was a man that bragged about, you know, bedding married women, that often talked about women in lewd terms or whatever. But you know, I think there was some perception that Donald Trump is something of an entertainer. I mean, when he goes on Howard Stern or whatever, he's like portrays this big, you know, New York buffoon. But hearing him make these comments in private, I think really just sort of like set people off, like made people connect that this is really who he is. And then on top of that, I just think that it was just, you know, a situation where, you know, we're reaching critical mass. We've had to defend Donald Trump on, Republicans have had to defend Donald Trump on so many different points that they just, you know, couldn't do it anymore. And this is just, you know, one more thing that they couldn't tolerate. And I do think that, to be honest, there is a visceral reaction that a lot of women in this country, regardless of whether they're conservative or liberal, have to comments like that. And it just, you know, made it very, very untenable for a lot of people to continue supporting that.
Two other questions on this. This is a general impression. I wonder what you think about this, Molly. It struck me after I watched that second debate, and I watched it with a great amount of unease because I knew what the subject matter was going to be initially. And then it was just kind of embarrassing. It's always kind of tense, awkward, and embarrassing at the same time to watch these things. But it struck me about Donald Trump, and maybe it's one of the few things I admire about him, maybe, is that he is the least calculating politician I have ever witnessed. He simply thinks and says, or maybe just says and then thinks. On the other hand, Hillary Clinton is perhaps the most calculating politician I've ever seen. What do you make of that impression?
I think that's interesting. I hadn't really thought of it in terms of calculation. I mean, certainly we have many years of experience with how calculated the Clintons are in their rise to political power. I've noticed something also throughout this election. It seemed to me that these two candidates are something of a mirror image of each other. This is actually something Mark has talked about at length. And if you see that one has a problem in one area, the other one does too. You know, even on the sexual entitlement issue, Hillary Clinton has her own problems with smearing women sexually if it helps her with her rise to power. They both have foundation problems. They both have corruption problems. They also both have interesting ways of talking. Like, Donald Trump says things that are not true, and he speaks very vaguely. He's sort of protected by the vagueness with which he speaks. And Hillary Clinton says things that are not true, and she's protected by the precise, lawyerly nature of it. And so I wonder if that doesn't play into what you're saying, which is, you know, she's very calculated with her language and the way that she tells things that are not true. It's a very calculated thing. In his case, he's so imprecise that it's kind of hard to nail him on his falsehoods or whatnot. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, it was a very awkward moment, but I thought it was also handled better by both Trump and Clinton than it was Anderson Cooper. I mean, he really wanted to ask questions and have a particular spin on his questions about the 11-year-old audio tape, and he really wanted to make it a focus of the debate. It seemed like neither Clinton nor Trump really wanted to. They at least said they wanted to talk about more important issues, and they were able to quickly move on to those more important issues.
I think that insight about, you know, calculation is right on. It just, the problem here is that when it comes to these kinds of, when it comes to both candidates, it's kind of darned if you do, darned if you don't, in the sense that, you know, Trump is the least calculating politician, you know, maybe we've ever seen, but that also means that he literally can't think two steps ahead and just says whatever's at the top of his head, even if it's incredibly offensive or incredibly stupid or incredibly authoritarian or whatever it is. And at the same time, you know, Hillary Clinton has been plotting her rise to the presidency, you know, for decades, and it really shows, and she comes off as phony and insincere and as someone who is totally willing to lie, and not only that, is so calculating. I think she's in absolute denial about, for instance, her own wrongdoing, and that's part of the reason why she can't handle the email scandals, because she's not at all contrite about it, because she doesn't believe she did anything wrong. I look at that situation there, you know, them being on the opposite end of that, and I wish that there were another option here.
Molly spoke earlier, Mark, about the collusion, the possible collusion between the Clinton camp and the Justice Department, but also recently, at least according to WikiLeaks, there's collusion between the Clinton camp and the New York Times and other press outlets. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's part of the WikiLeaks emails, and actually we'd seen this before in the other emails that were released as a result of the FBI investigation from State Department emails. The media have an incredibly cozy relationship with Hillary Clinton. There's a New York Times reporter named John Harwood who was constantly sending Clinton and her people flattering notes apropos nothing, not even like pegged through media requests. We saw, you know, another email in the WikiLeaks thing that had one of Chris Hayes, as a show on MSNBC producer, just saying unbelievably fawning things about what a wonderful human being Hillary Clinton was. In earlier emails, we saw there was a reporter at Politico that was actually running his story by the Clinton camp before it was even published. I mean, these are just, you know, incredible abrogations of media responsibility and the notion that media should have an adversarial relationship with those in power. But the reality is the Clintons are very good at this, and they know darn good and well that we're there, as far as this is concerned, that they control things. They control access, and they are going to string the media along and to do whatever they want, and the media are just willing to roll over and comply with it. And I think this is part of the reason behind the rise of Trump is, you know, even if people hadn't seen these emails, they just knew, you know, implicitly that there was this giant apparatus in Washington that was all one big, you know, happy family where they were all sucking up the people in power, and they get tired of the throne sniffing, and, you know, they wanted somebody who was completely outside the system. You know, I'm not sure Donald Trump is quite that guy in a lot of ways that it would be the savior from that kind of system, but, you know, certainly he does represent, you know, a giant, say, middle finger to that kind of cozy Washington establishment.
Molly, how would you describe the jumping on and off and sometimes riding along on the running boards of the Trump bandwagon by evangelical leaders and by GOP leaders?
Well, there have been a lot of people upset with evangelical support for Trump, and I think it's a little bit more complicated than people are saying. We discussed a long time ago how the most significant factor in whether or not you jumped on the Trump train or not, if you were a normal person, was how much you went to church. So the more likely you were to go to church regularly, the less likely you were to be a Trump voter in the Republican primary. Once Trump got the nomination, he managed to get most of the Republicans slowly but surely to be on board with him, which includes a sizable evangelical contingent. What's really interesting is the divide in the evangelical elites. You had prominent people who never got on board, such as Russell Moore, who spoke against Trump and his moral problems and has been fairly consistent that way. You also had a lot of the old guard religious right institutions enthusiastically embracing Trump even before he locked up the nomination, excusing his appearances in pornography magazines and excusing his multiple divorces and his adultery and the way he talked about women. And so with the revelation of this latest tape from 2001 that shows Donald Trump speaking this way in private, was interesting was that most evangelical leaders stood by him or just remained silent. A few people did jump off the Trump Express at that point, including Wayne Grudem, who had been very prominent in helping people justify their support for Donald Trump. At the same, and so this is a very interesting just discussion on the evangelical right now, or even just evangelicals in general, about how much you should get in bed with a politician who has the problems that Donald Trump has. A lot of people are very upset that any evangelicals ever got behind Donald Trump. At the same time, all this jumping off is not as easy as I think people are trying to make it seem, in that if you do believe in political action and you are not voting for Donald Trump, are you switching your vote to Hillary Clinton? She has her own serious problems in terms of policies that are at odds with the evangelical political agenda, including support for religious liberty and support for sanctity of human life and whatnot. So it's a very complicated story, and people are trying to figure out where they want to be. The people who seem to have fared best were those who, religious leaders who emphasized religion more than politics, and who said that the primacy of the gospel is more important than who you're voting for and whatnot, who understand that different people might make different decisions based on the knowledge that's available to them, and who understand that this is a very dark election for Christians.
Molly Hemingway, senior editor for The Federalist. Mark Hemingway, senior writer for The Weekly Standard. It's our update on the November elections. We'll talk about Speaker Paul Ryan's press conference after this. At Concordia University Irvine, you can pursue advanced theological study for academic, professional, or personal development. Concordia's Master of Arts in Theology program is grounded in the truth of Scripture and insights from the Lutheran Confessions. Courses are taught online and at intensive on-campus sessions in the summer. Apologetics, Christian education leadership, and Reformation studies are just a few of the emphases offered. For more information, visit cui.edu/theology.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Are you a homeschool parent looking for help teaching certain subjects? Or do you want your student to study the history, languages, and literature of Western civilization? Memoria Press Online Academy has live online classes with master teachers to help you. Their teachers have years of experience teaching, delighting, and moving students literally from all around the world. Your homeschool year doesn't have to be difficult. Visit MemoriaPressAcademy.com or call 877-745-8866.
Mark Hemingway of the Weekly Standard, Molly Hemingway of the Federalist, are our guests for our weekly update on the November elections on this Tuesday, October the 11th. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Mark, what's the latest word from Speaker Paul Ryan on everything we've been discussing here?
He held a press conference yesterday with a bunch of Republican members of the House where he basically said, look, it's up to you whether or not you want to support Trump. He's become obviously an albatross around your necks electorally. And he had also announced that after the Trump tape broke on Friday that he was supposed to appear at a rally with Trump in Wisconsin over the weekend, and he disinvited Trump from his own rally. And he's also announced that he is not going to be actively supporting Trump in the future, though he had not rescinded his endorsement of Trump. Though having now this all happened in the last couple of days, and I think just in the last couple of hours, there's a political story out now saying that Paul Ryan may rescind his Trump endorsement before Election Day. So, you know, it's really hard to tell what to make of it. I mean, you could make a pretty compelling case that Paul Ryan made a mistake in endorsing Trump altogether. What I think, though, is true is that Paul Ryan endorsed Trump only insofar as he felt that he was in a unique position as Speaker of the House to retain that Republican majority in the House in the event that Hillary Clinton was elected, so that they could be a bulwark against her, you know, enacting all kinds of damaging legislation. So he felt that in order to hold the GOP coalition together and preserve their chances of maintaining their House majority, he had to put on a brave face and endorse the nominee and encourage the party to sort of roughly hang together. Trump's free fall in the polls the last couple of days has sort of like rendered that somewhat untenable, although, you know, there's still an argument to be had that holding together is the GOP's best argument to retain their House majority. But the polls are really bad. And NBC's latest poll, I think, had the Democrats or Republicans on the so-called generic ballot up 6 or 7 points, and anything over more than 3-point advantage for Democrats would be, you know, putting the Republican House in play. So they've really got to think very carefully at what stance they need to adopt toward Trump to retain their House majority, because I think that was Paul Ryan's goal all along. Obviously, he hesitated initially to endorse Trump, and I think privately there's little doubt in my mind that Paul Ryan does not like Donald Trump or his character or what he stands for.
Molly, I'm thinking about a piece that George Will put out over the weekend calling the Trump candidacy chemotherapy for the GOP. Necessary, painful, and let's see it through to the end so that we make sure that it's completely does its work. And he, is, of course, has never been any great fan of Trump's candidacy. What do you think of the metaphor?
I think there's something to it. I've been finding this late action by Republicans very interesting in that they fought so hard against those Republican delegates to the convention who wanted to do something other than have Donald Trump. And even a few weeks ago, you had Republican elite saying that unless you give a full-throated endorsement of Donald Trump, you wouldn't be allowed to run for president in the future and whatnot. And now they're all jumping ship, and it just seems like a lot of back and forth. George Will left the Republican Party when it endorsed Donald Trump. He opposes everything Donald Trump stands for, and he spared no unkind words for what's going on there. I do think it would be I do think that in the chaos of this moment, there are things that might be good that are coming out of this. And it's almost more important how people respond to the moment than whatever happens in this given moment. But there seems that a lot of people at the leadership of the party are interested in not learning any lessons from the anger of their own voters and what that anger signifies. I also think there's something needs to be said about the, frankly, the immaturity of the voters who put us in this situation where they, I mean, a lot of people who I spoke to who were Trump enthusiasts in the beginning, they assured me that not only was Donald Trump the only person who could beat Hillary Clinton, but that he would defeat her in a landslide. And so that is kind of the standard that I have been holding these people to who thought that it was good to reject all these other Republican candidates in favor of someone who had such unorthodox views. They said he would defeat Hillary Clinton in a landslide. Now, we will see if that happens. There's another month to go, but the polls are not looking so good. And should he not defeat her in a landslide, should he not defeat her at all, I would like for everybody to think about what it all means. The voters need to think about the prudence of selecting a candidate such as Donald Trump. The elites need to think about the very legitimate problems that the voters have with how the Republican Party has been governing things. Conservative media needs to think about whether it educated people or just fed anger, whether it was accurate about what was possible in the political realm. I think religious leaders need to think about why they're so obsessed about politics and not about the spiritual condition, the religious condition, the message that they have shared. There are a lot of lessons to go around, and I hope that when this is all said and done, no matter the outcome, that people will think a little bit more deeply about what it means to be an actor in a self-governed country.
Mark, finally, you hail from Mormon country, and speaking of religious leaders, they are of a different stripe and perhaps off the beaten path.
Yeah.
But the Mormons have, at least in the words of one story from Politico, have mounted an insurrection against the candidacy of Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, polling as far back as the spring showed that Mormons or Utah in general had no love for Donald Trump. I mean, he was showing up absolutely abysmally in the polls there. And I think it has to do with the fact that, you know, Mormons, particularly in Utah, still very much have a very sort of old-fashioned view of morality that Donald Trump just does not fit into in terms of, you know, the way he talks about women and you know, his general vulgarity that really turned off Mormons. But recently there have been some movement in this direction where the Deseret News, which is a newspaper owned by the Mormon Church, and although it's not supposed to like be, you know, officially the word of the Mormon Church, came out and editorialized and said that, you know, that you could not in good conscience vote for good Donald Trump, and the most recent tape of him talking literally about women, quote, oozes evil. I mean, a lot of Mormons will take that editorial as being a message from the church that they are not to vote for Donald Trump. And then on top of that, Evan McMullen, this, you know, third party candidate who entered into the race very late in the game, is a total independent, is Mormon. And he's the only place in the country he's attracted a surprising amount of support is Utah. I believe he's in double digits there. So I think people in Utah see voting for Evan McMullen as a viable opportunity to express their disgust with the Republican Party at this point in time. So, it would be impossible for any Republican to win the White House when Utah was when there's a possibility you're going to lose Utah. And some of those polls earlier in the year show that, you know, if the race were divided, you know, three or four ways, Gary Johnson's also gathered, the Libertarian candidates gathered significant support in Utah, then, you know, it's not unthinkable, unlikely, but it's not unthinkable that Trump could lose Utah.
You can follow Mark Hemingway on Twitter at Heminator, HEMINATOR, and Molly on Twitter at MZ Hemingway. Molly Hemingway is senior editor for The Federalist. Molly, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Mark Hemingway, senior writer for the Weekly Standard. Mark, thanks.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll continue our series, Classroom Apologetics, talking with Dr. Mark Kaltoff about European and American History 101. If you walk into that classroom in high school or in college and university, what kind of challenges will you meet to the Christian worldview and to the Christian faith? We'll also discuss justification in the Old Testament. Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer will be our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
When you need a friend, you have a friend in Jesus Christ, the Good Shepherd, and friends among His people at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, Arnold, Missouri. At Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, we offer Christ-centered word and sacrament ministry, inspirational liturgical worship services, and faithful preaching and teaching. Sunday worship services are at 9 a.m. Sunday school and Bible class are at 10:30. We also have an excellent Christian preschool. We invite you to join us. Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, 2211 Tenbrook Road, Arnold, Missouri, 636-296-1292.
I'm talking with regular guest Dr. Ken Sherb about a new book by one of his former professors. Which one, Ken?
The late Dr. Kurt Marquardt. And the book is The Saving Truth, Doctrine for Lay People.
You edited this book.
Yeah, the unpublished manuscript was among Marquardt's papers, and it is vintage Marquardt, lively, engaging, centering in the Christ who saves, with an apologetics chapter at the end.
You can find out more about Saving Truth, Doctrine for Lay People at lutheracademy.com.